Right, good evening, everybody. Welcome to the Socialist Party West London branch meeting. I've done a talk about the Paris Commune last year and the year before, but this talk will incorporate a few things I've talked about before, but quite a few different things because I've read more widely on the subject over the last few months. So hopefully it will be more interesting, say, than previous ones. So I'm not going to talk about all the bloodshed. That's out. I've talked about that before. I'm not going to talk about the lessons of the Paris Commune, which was last year's title. So I've called it the biggest festival of the 19th century, which I've taken it from the Situationist theses on the Paris Commune, which were published in the early 1960s. So to introduce the talk, I will quote the first thesis, which is, "The Commune was the biggest festival of the 19th century. Underlying the events of that spring of 1871, one can see the insurgents feeling that they had become the masters of their own history, not so much on the level of governmental politics as on the level of their everyday life." So the Paris Commune lasted for about 72 days, 18th of March to the 28th of May, 1871. It's when the Parisian working class created organisations which challenged the old system for a brief space of time. It is significant in the history of the struggles of our class. There was a fundamental interruption of the ruling order and the appearance of new forms and conceptions of everyday life. The brief example shows that real change can be brought about by workers. It was unprecedented. Never had a government claimed to represent the interests of the working class. Marx noted in 1871, the most important point was its existence, workers governing Paris, the Commune, as a form of political organisation. The Situationists add, the Paris Commune was a positive experiment whose whole truth has yet to be rediscovered and fulfilled. So before I start talking about the Paris Commune, just what was happening in Paris and France just before the Commune. The Second Empire of Napoleon III had been in power since 1852. It was a very centralised authoritarian state. Workers' conditions were deplorable, living on subsistence wages, long hours. There was child labour, there was a constant threat of sudden unemployment, living conditions, slum housing, disease, destitution, degradation, and rising living costs. There was an economic depression in the late 1860s, which was devastating both for the working class and many sectors of the petty bourgeoisie. And then in 1870, there was the Franco-Prussian War. The Prussians encircled Paris in September 1870 after the complete rout of the French army at Sedan. 60,000 Parisians died during the siege of 1870 to 1871. Marx called it 6 months of hunger and ruin. There was starvation, unemployment, soaring prices, and the small shopkeepers were ruined. The provisional government authorised enlistment of 384,000 men in 284 neighbourhood battalions of the National Guard. So the working class in Paris effectively were armed and they elected their own officers. Now during the siege, production virtually ceased. Therefore, daily pay, according to National Guard members, became the sole source of sustenance for the majority of workers and shopkeepers. Marx wrote, "Thiers roused all the indebted commerce of Paris. By his law on Paris house rents, he menaced all Paris. Laws were to punish Paris for having saved the honour of France and delayed the surrender to Bismarck for 6 months." Brecht, in his play Days of the Commune, has a character say, "The people offered itself as a bulwark against the foreign invaders, again to be abused and degraded until the 18th of March, 1871. So the beginning of the Commune, the Thiers government and the bourgeoisie fled to Versailles. As Kropotkin nicely put it, the government evaporated like a pond of stagnant water in a spring breeze. Two French generals, General Clement Thomas, who was the butcher of the June days in 1848, he'd killed a lot of the Paris working class in that year, and he was shot by the National Guard. Marx wrote about him, that he had never dipped his sword in the blood of any other enemy but that of the Paris working class. Another general, General Lecomte, was also shot by the National Guard. Marx described him as a epauletted cutthroat. He had four times commanded his troops on the Place Pigalle to charge an unarmed gathering of women and children. Instead of shooting the people, the soldiers shot him. Bertolt Brecht has characters say, "We are the law, they were tried by the people." The manifesto of the 18th of March stated, "The proletarians of Paris, amidst the failures and treason of the ruling classes, have understood that the hour struck for them to save the situation by taking into their own hands the direction of public affairs to render themselves masters of their own destinies." An interesting incident on the 18th of March 1871 at the Place Pigalle, French troops were actually faced by a very different enemy, the swell mobsmen and prostitutes of the outer boulevards. I had to look up what mobsmen meant, actually. A swell's mobsman was a criminal such as a pickpocket who dresses fashionably and conducts himself with seeming respectability for professional purposes. So a central committee of the National Guard was elected without distinction of rank from the various companies. It took over control of affairs in Paris and set about the job of maintaining distribution of what food and supplies were available and seeing to the general running of the city. On the 19th of March, the first business of the new government was to reorganise the public services, which had been thrown into disorder by the withdrawal of most of the civil servants, expressly ordered by Thiers to sabotage the revolution. In 6 days, the public services were working almost normally. The regular postal service was restored. Cafes and theatres were open as usual. There were even two first nights, a review at the Folies Bergères on the 20th of March and a vaudeville at the Folies Dramatiques. There were elections to the Commune on the 26th of March, and voting was completely free. There had never been an election in Paris that had passed off so freely and tranquilly. When the results were announced outside the Hôtel de Ville, crowds of people with red flags, red scarves and scarlet draperies hid the equestrian statue of Henry IV, and people were singing La Marseillaise and Salut and other French popular tunes. Commune member Jules Vallée wrote in his newspaper, "Today is the festive wedding day of the idea and the revolution. Soldier citizens, the commune we have acclaimed and married today must tomorrow bear fruit. We must take our place once more, still proud and now free, in the workshop and at the counter, after the poetry of triumph, the prose of work." Frank Jelinek writes that the population was at fever heat. I want to talk very, very briefly about the Paris middle class, the petty bourgeoisie, or even the middle bourgeoisie. I mean, this was the first time, Marx said, this was the first revolution in which the working class was openly acknowledged as the only class capable of social initiative, even by the great bulk of the Paris middle class, shopkeepers, tradesmen and merchants. I mean, in 1871, the middle class was the debtor class to the capitalist creditor class. Also, the shopkeepers, tradesmen and merchants believed the bourgeois class had insulted their Voltairianism by handing over the education of their children to the ignorant brothers, or the Jesuits. So in 1871, the middle class was delivered by the workmen's revolution from bourgeois sham representation. They came out in their true colours and disavowed Versailles and marched under the banner of the Commune. They openly rallied around the workmen's revolution and proclaimed it as the only means of their own salvation. Delegates of the National Union of the Syndical Chambers, who were also Freemasons, represented 56 organisations with nearly 7,000 Paris industrialists and merchants. They twice went to the Hôtel de Ville to speak in front of the Commune and declare their support for the Commune. So you can imagine a mixture of Masonic banners and red flags. So the middle class felt that the working class could emancipate them from priest rule and convert science from an instrument of class rule into a popular force. I mean, Marx talked about the abolition of the centralised state power with its ubiquitous organs of standing army, police, bureaucracy, clergy and judicature. I mean, the police are the abrasive edge of the state, and the Paris police force, the prefecture, which had been originally established by Napoleon in 1800, was abolished. I mean, most police went to Versailles, where they were welcomed as saviours, and there was self-policing of the different parts of Paris. In the period, the 18th to the 28th of March, there were only two arrests for theft. The people who were arrested included Prussian spies, Versailles spies, Bonapartist police, gendarmes, magistrates, Jesuits, priests, and other Second Empire notables. In the first week after the 18th of March, Public order had never been so little disturbed. Crimes of violence were few. Robbery decreased notably. The streets were quiet. Not a murder nor a robbery for 3 weeks. Public prostitution disappeared almost all from the streets in April. Engels writes about the abolition of the scandalous Paris morality police. Now, I had to actually do some research about that because Engels doesn't actually elaborate on that. But the morality police were, well, the policeman was the most powerful person in a prostitute's life. Now, no law was ever passed on prostitution in the 19th century in France. The police tried to control it with different tactics, and rules for prostitutes were first implemented in 1810. Every prostitute was required to register with the police, which brought authorization to conduct her illegal trade in a relatively unhampered manner. In return, she had to submit to regular medical examinations for venereal disease. The prostitute was arrested if she broke a regulation or did not appear for a medical examination or caused a disturbance. I mean, the prostitute was then considered outside the law and thus was led away from the judicial track to the Morals Brigade, whom usually sentenced the prostitutes to stay in the Petit Fours prison, where some 400 prostitutes were incarcerated. I mean, this Morals Brigade was a section of the Paris police devoted entirely towards policing prostitution. I mean, the brigade's agents would begin to pick up young working class women indiscriminately just to fill their daily quota of arrests. And at one time, the Morals Brigade were picked up by accident a well-known actress. Artiste Corbet, he was a commune member, he wrote, "I'm enchanted. Paris is a veritable paradise. No police, no outrages, no quarrels, no exactions of any kind. Paris is moving under its own steam, as smoothly as you could wish. We must try to be always like this." I mean, Brecht has a character in his play say, "This will be the first night in the history of Paris when there'll be no murder, no cheating, no attacks on women. This is the first time it's safe to walk on the streets. We don't need the police. The bankers, the swindlers, tax collectors, factory owners, priests, prostitutes and politicians have all run off to Versailles. At long last, Paris is a fit place to live in." I mean, a great many priests were arrested. But at Easter 1871, which was the 9th of April that year, the Paris market women actually rose in fury to protest the arrest of their favourite priest. I mean, a certificate of good citizenship was issued and he was released. There were a large number of convicts in the ranks of the insurrection. Prisons had been very frequently stormed to release political prisoners, and numerous convicts had taken advantage of this. Another line I came across during my research was, no more corpses at the morgue, no nocturnal burglaries, scarcely any robberies. In fact, for the first time since the days of 1848, the streets were safe, and that without any police of any kind. It was the no more corpses at the morgue that interested me, so I did a little bit of research. I found out in 1867, the Paris morgue was opened, and there was 40,000 visitors a day. It was open to the public, and it was a place of entertainment for Parisians and tourists alike. I mean, the original purpose of the morgue was, of course, not to attract tourism, but to identify unknown bodies found in the city, many that had been fished out of the Seine, or suicides that no one had reported missing. Their unfortunate remains were displayed on slanted marble tables behind glass, inviting friends and families to claim the deceased. Word of the morbid and free exhibition of dead bodies quickly spread, and soon the morgue became a fixture on the Paris social circuit. To delay decomposition of the bodies, cold water was dripped continuously from overhead taps. The victims' clothes and belongings hung on pegs behind them. I mean, after the Commune, obviously, the morgue was reopened for all this public viewing. It was eventually ended in 1907. Let's quote a reader's letter to a newspaper during the Commune. This reader writes, Enduring these last 20 years has taught us what to expect from sophists and fine talkers. Now that working class has come to power, is it more qualified to conduct our affairs than messieurs, the lawyers? I have no answer. I have no hesitation in answering in the affirmative. And the number of newspapers and magazines published in the Paris during the Commune expanded exponentially. Highly popular publication was the Le Père Duchesne. It specialised in humour, vulgarity and extreme abuse against opponents of the Commune. When the Versailles bombardment of Paris began at Easter 1871, Crowds of strollers thronged the Champs-Élysées to watch the shells break in the clear sky over the Arc de Triomphe. Men and women were sipping their beer with the calmest air in the world, listening to an old woman playing a violin. In the Tuileries gardens during the Commune, audiences 15,000 strong sang along to the Internationale, listened to edifying arias by Gounod, Verdi and Meyerbeer, laughed at satirical political sketches and enjoyed recitals of Victor Hugo's poems. On Sunday, the 21st of May, 1871, which was the day of the last session of the Commune, and it was also the day that the Versailles entered the outer reaches of Paris, there was a grand concert in the Tuileries Gardens. From 300 yards away, Versailles shells were burst onto the bottom of the Champs-Élysées. But fishing had begun, and the quays were filled with anglers. In the streets, life went on as usual. I mean, this Sunday, the theatres were more packed than ever. At the Gymnase, it was gala night, a premiere. The box office took 2,355 francs. I mean, Brecht writes, as a character say in his play, "But what are people? I tried to go to a concert in the Tuileries tonight, in aid of the ambulances. They expected a few hundred listeners, but 10,000 turned up." I mean, there was in fact a fundraising concert in the Tuileries Garden on the 21st of May, just as the Versailles army was entering the city, heralding the start of Bloody Week. This is a nice little quote from Lenin. It's in the State and Revolution, and he says, "How readily people become accustomed to observing the necessary rules of social intercourse when there is no exploitation, when there is nothing that arouses indignation, evokes protest and revolt." Colette Wilson wrote, "With Paris cut off from the rest of the country, it felt as if the city was living in a time outside of ordinary time. It was cherry time, after a popular song written by Jean-Baptiste Clément in 1867. I'm not going to really look at the achievements or what the actual Commune did. I'm going to talk now about women in the Paris Commune. I mean, they played an active role in the Paris Commune. It was feminism in action. I mean, the Parisian working-class women were the real women of Paris, heroic, noble and devoted, like the women of antiquity. In her memoirs, Louise Michel writes, "People didn't worry about which sex they were before they did their duty. That stupid question was settled." An interesting incident took place on the 2nd of April, which is quite early on in the Commune. 300 women had gathered at the statue of Strasbourg in the Place de la Concorde, originally in order to go to Versailles to try for conciliation, but they marched instead up the Champs-Élysées behind a red flag, demanding to be led against the Versailles enemy. I mean, many women joined the Commune in order to help their men by providing food and tending to the wounded. I mean, during Bloody Week in May, women's battalions fought on the barricades. This is a women's citizen's address to the Commune on the 14th of April. "That the Commune, representing the principle of extinction of all privilege and all inequality, should therefore consider all legitimate grievances of any section of the population without discrimination of sex, such discrimination having made and enforced as a means of maintaining the privileges of the ruling classes." And political clubs were opened in churches. This is a woman speaker at a political club meeting during the Commune, where she says, "Yes, you women are oppressed, but just have a little more patience, for the day that will bring justice and satisfaction for our demands is rapidly approaching. Tomorrow you will belong to yourselves and not to exploiters. The factories in which you are crowded together will belong to you. The tools placed in your hands will belong to you. The profit that results from your labour, your care, the loss of your health will be shared among you." Louise Michel was a member of the National Guard, an ambulance woman. She treated those wounded on the barricades, and she was with the Communards at the last stand in the Montmartre Cemetery. She was chair of the Women's Vigilance Committee, and she played a leading role in mobilising women in support of the Commune, and she organised daycare for 200 children living in besieged Paris. She recruited women as ambulance workers, even among the prostitutes from her suburb. Rejecting her male compatriots' concern that the wounded must be tended by pure hands, she argued, "Who is more right than these women, the most pitiful of the old order's victims, to give their life for the new?" She's even referred to in the Commune's official journal of the 10th of April, not by name, but they are describing her. An energetic woman has been fighting in the ranks of the 61st Battalion and has killed several police and soldiers. In between the fighting, she read the works of Baudelaire and played the harmonium at a church. In her memoirs, she writes, "Yes, barbarian that I was, I loved the cannon, the smell of gunpowder and grape shot in the air. But above all, I was in love with the revolution. Every evening, we would burst out into the streets from our headquarters of the Vigilance Committee, sometimes simply to talk up the revolution, because the time for duplicity had passed. We knew how little the reactionary regime, in its death throes, valued its promises and the lives of its citizens, and the people had to be warned." The Women's Union for the Defence of Paris and the Care of the Wounded was another organisation founded in April 1871. I mean, they proposed a number of things. Obviously, these things never actually came to pass. You know, gender equality, wages equality, the right of divorce for women, the right to secular education, professional education for girls, the abolition of the distinction between married women and concubines, the abolition of prostitution, the closing of the official brothels, and abolishing the distinction between legitimate and illegitimate children. And they organised cooperative workshops and ran a free food restaurant. I mean, after the Commune, bourgeois lies and propaganda about working-class women in the Commune portrayed them as fire starters. But because of this myth, hundreds of working-class women were murdered in Paris in late May 1871. Yeah, I want to quote another thesis from the Situationists in 1962. And they wrote, "The Commune represents the only implementation of a revolutionary urbanism to date. Attacking on the spot the petrified signs of the dominant organisation of life, understanding social space in political terms. All space is already occupied by the enemy. Authentic urbanism will appear when the absence of this occupation is created in certain zones. What we call construction starts here." The Commune can be seen as the reappropriation of the urban space on behalf of the Parisian working class. I mean, the Parisian working class were returning to the city centre to reclaim their space after many had been forced out of the city centre as a result of Baron Haussmann's building schemes of the 1850s and 60s. So the Commune can be seen as a concerted attempt to reappropriate the city after its embourgeoisement by Haussmann. You know, the Parisian working class districts of faubourgs comprising dense streets and medieval alleyways were destroyed by the renovations under Haussmann, which would better able the bourgeoisie to control the Paris working class. Another notorious faubourg was the Faubourg Saint-Jacques. In Victor Hugo's words, "This place, which was, as it were, predestined, it has always been horrible. The Faubourg Saint-Jacques was a dumping ground for garbage and even corpses in the 18th century, and it remained notorious as a refuge for the pitifully poor, the unwanted and the unemployed. It was also the site of public executions until 1870. This seemed appropriate to the bourgeoisie, who viewed the fringes of urban life with disdain. So slums for centuries crowded the area between the Louvre and the courtyard of the Tuileries Palace until the completion of the Louvre extension in 1857. Now, while the clearances had in fact started in 1849, in the 1850s, most of the area remained untouched and still formed part of the city's public space. In Balzac's 1846 novel, Cousin Betty, her residence is in the impoverished residential area which surrounded the Louvre. He wrote, "Darkness, silence, an icy chill, and the cavernous depths of the soil combine to make these houses a kind of crypt, tombs of the living." I mean, Haussmann's schemes inspired Baudelaire's meditation on the death of the old city in The Swan, because it not only displaced the slum dwellers, but also effectively closed off these areas to the people of Paris. So the Paris of cramped streets and housing, dense and irregular medieval alleyways, the Parisian iron and glass covered arcades which were built at the beginning of the 19th century, which had been written about by Walter Benjamin in his arcades project, a lot of these were destroyed by the city renovations. I mean, Haussmann's primary aim was to control the public space and therefore the public, widen the streets, create boulevards so troops can move down easily and the working class would be unable to build barricades. I mean, the bourgeois had memories of 1789, 1830 and 1848, when the working class had taken control of the city. So what I'm actually talking about, I'm talking about gentrification here. It's a creation of a bourgeois city centre with a working class periphery. As David Harvey points out, though, the more city space is opened up, the more it has to be partitioned and closed off. I mean, the urban regeneration carried on after the Second Empire and into the Third Republic after the demise of the Commune, and working class areas were destroyed and populations were moved to the outer areas of Paris. I mean, Haussmann was annoyed that he had not completed his city reorganisation when he heard about the proclamation of the Paris Commune. I mean, the Third Republic would complete Haussmann's projects in the 1870s. I mean, it has to be said that bourgeois Parisians were actually angry at the invasion of their city by working class communards. Second Empire supporter Maxime Ducamp, writing in the 1870s after the Commune, he basically fully supports the destruction of the old city to make way for the new, prosperous, healthy and law-abiding metropolis. And he states that Haussmann was right when he claimed that the more Paris was opened up, made light and airy, the more it would attract foreign visitors who would spend their money in the city and thereby enrich the whole population. Ducamp's emphasis is on banishing the physical, social and moral decay festering in the city's ancient streets. You know, he believed the sooner the new Boulevard Saint-Germain was completed by demolishing the old alleyways on the left bank and connect the Avenue de l'Opera with the Tuileries Gardens by flattening the ancient filthy slum area around the Butte des Moulins. For Ducamp, the demolition of such middens, dens of iniquity, and their replacement with healthy homes. He believed these schemes, together with improvements in street lighting, do more for the city's security than any moralist's sermon. I want to talk about destruction now, demolition of property. One of the theses by the Situationists. It's quite controversial what they're saying here. It's saying the story of the arsonists who, during the final days of the Commune, went to destroy Notre Dame, only to find it defended by an armed battalion of commune artists, is a richly provocative example of direct democracy. It gives an idea of the kind of problems that will need to be resolved in the perspective of the power of the councils. Were those artists right to defend a cathedral in the name of eternal aesthetic values, and in the final analysis, in the name of museum culture, while other people wanted to express themselves then and there by making this destruction symbolise their absolute defiance of a society that in its moment of triumph was about to consign their entire lives to silence and oblivion? I mean, the passion for destruction is a creative passion, said Bakunin. Again, the Situationists go on saying that the communards refuse to accept the innocence of any monument. Anyone who disparages this attack as some lumpen proletarian nihilism, some irresponsibility of the firestarters, should specify what he believes to be of positive value in the present society and worth preserving. It will turn out to be almost everything. So what did the Commune actually destroy? Well, Napoleon Bonaparte's triumphal column at the Place Vendôme, which was a symbol of chauvinism and mutual hatred amongst nations, that was demolished. I mean, this column had been modelled on a Roman emperor's column in Rome. It was erected in 1810 to commemorate Napoleon's victory at Austerlitz in 1805. It was covered with a bronze shell made from the actual cannon captured from the Austrians and Russians, both material and symbolic embodiment of France's military glory. I mean, Napoleon was dressed as a Roman Empire, and it came to stand for Napoleonic imperialism, which is why the Commune voted to demolish it. I mean, Courbet, again, the artist, I've mentioned him earlier, he was quite instrumental in the fact that this was demolished. He wrote, "Inasmuch as the Vendôme column is a monument devoid of all artistic value, tending to perpetuate by its expression the ideas of war and conquest of the past imperial dynasty, which are reproved by a republican nation sentiment, Citizen Courbet expresses the wish that the National Defence Government will authorise him to disassemble this column." He actually used his own word, déboulement, which is to deflate like a balloon, as he believed it was hollow. So the Commune voted for the demolition. They decided that it was a monument of barbarism, a symbol of brute force and false glory, an affirmation of militarism and a negation of international right. And it was demolished on the 16th of May, and it was a ritualised demolition. People were invited, a band played the Marseillaise. I mean, a lot of buildings were destroyed in the final bombardment in the final week of the Commune, and a lot of things were set on fire. I mean, a lot of it would have been destroyed by the Versailles bombardment. But the only thing that the Communards did not deny having willfully set alight was the Tuileries Palace. Now, this had been the residence of most of the monarchs of France from the 16th century right up to Napoleon III. And it was burned down by the Communards during Bloody Week. And like I say, they did not deny this. They thought this was an act and a right thing to do. And they wrote and they sent their message to the Hotel de Ville and they said, "The last vestiges of royalty have just disappeared. I wish that the same will happen to all the monuments of Paris." A couple of other instances of, three more instances of destruction of property. The Chapel of Atonement of Louis XVI, which had been built in 1816 at the time of the Bourbon Restoration after the Revolutionary and Napoleonic period. This was for the expiation of sins of the Parisian people for guillotining Louis XVI in 1793. I mean, the Commune decided it was a permanent insult to the First Revolution and a perpetual protest against the people's justice. I don't know if they actually demolished this chapel, but they did propose the demolition of a chapel commemorating General Breyer. Now, he was a general who commanded some of the troops that suppressed the June insurrection of the Paris working class in 1848. And he was killed by insurgents at the gates of Fontainebleau. And two insurgents were actually executed for his murder. And again, they proposed the demolition of this chapel, but I couldn't find out whether it had actually been demolished or not. And finally, on the destruction and demolition, the destruction of the home of Adolphe Thiers, the Prime Minister. Marx wrote about him that he was that monstrous gnome. He charmed the French bourgeoisie for almost half a century because he is the most consummate intellectual expression of their own class corruption. He was consistent only in his greed for wealth and his hatred of the men that produced it. I mean, a newspaper editor on the 6th of April had proposed the idea that they should destroy his house, and then it was decided on the 10th of May that they would do that. The works of art in the house were to be donated to the Louvre, which actually refused them, and the furniture was to be sold. The money given to widows and the orphans of the fighting. The house was emptied and destroyed on the 12th of May. So, in conclusion, I mean, we wrote in the Socialist Standard back in 1954 that the Paris Commune stands as an heroic landmark in the history of the working class and gives us an indication how workers can act when called upon to reorganise society. Edouard Vaillant wrote, "If socialism wasn't born of the Commune, it is from the Commune that dates that portion of the international revolution that no longer wants to give battle in a city in order to be surrounded and crushed, but which instead wants, at the head of the proletarians of each and every country, to attack national and international reaction and put an end to the capitalist regime." Again, we said in the Socialist Standard, this time in 1905, that the Commune were the bravest pioneers of the movement of the working class. The most glorious is saddest in the annals of the proletariat, showed the heroism working class are capable of, the unmistakable evidence of the powers latent in the proletariat, and the working class asserted their rights such as they understood them to be at that time. So I'm just going to end once more with a thesis from the Situationists on the Paris Commune. And they wrote, "Theoreticians who examine the history of this movement from a divinely omniscient viewpoint can easily demonstrate that the Commune was objectively doomed to failure and could not have been successfully consummated. They forget that for those who really lived it, the consummation was already there." Thank you.